You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Too often, when women are not interested in sex at the same levels as their male partners, they're told either that there's something wrong with them, or that they simply must force themselves to meet men's desires. In sex advice columns and self-help books, as well as in sex therapy, women are sometimes instructed to watch pornography with their partners, or they're told there must be something wrong with their relationships that they don't show interest or the same level of interest in penetrative, heteronormative sex. How does this, and sexology more broadly, reinforce ideas that harm women and perpetuate rape culture? Dr. Megan Tyler is a senior lecturer at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. She is the author of Selling Sex Short, The Sexological and Pornographic Construction of Women's Sexuality in the West, and the co-editor of Freedom Fallacy, The Limits of Liberal Feminism. I spoke with her over the phone from her home in Melbourne. Here is that interview. In your research on sex and relationship advice and on things like self-help books for women and sex therapy, I wonder generally what kinds of trends you've come across.
I think probably the strongest trend that I came across in reading through all the texts that I did for these pieces of research was probably just that an underlying constant pushing of women to accept whatever sexual demands a male partner wanted of them. And that often wasn't said really outright, you know, that isn't going to be the title of the book, but there's kind of constant pressure in there for women in heterosexual relationships. Whatever your male partner wants of you to be good sexually is to agree to that or find a way to pretend to enjoy it.
Right. I find it personally and politically troubling, actually, as a feminist and as an individual woman, that sex is really just taken for granted in relationships. You know, we hear messages like, if you aren't having sex, that's a sign of a bigger problem in your relationship. And of course, when we're talking about sex, we're talking about penetrative sex. And, you know, we equate relationships that don't include much or any penetrative sex to loveless marriages. We tell others or are told that if our partner isn't engaging in sex with us, we should leave them, or that we have the right to cheat. What's at the root of all of this? Why are these messages so accepted in our culture?
The existing literature long before I looked at this would just say the male sex right, really. That kind of men's sexual access to women is the cornerstone of heterosexuality, and that exists under unequal conditions of power. And so that women not submitting to sex acts that often they don't find particularly enjoyable is kind of then the downfall of the whole heterosexual construct. So it seems extremely threatening, maybe not consciously, to a lot of these sex therapists and sexologists, but that's really what all of this is sort of founded on. And just as you say, it really is penetrative sex. They might talk about it in other ways, but absolutely they take sex to mean heterosexual sex, and they take it as shorthand for coitus, really, in all instances. And there are some fascinating case studies that, you know, they've had of couples coming to them perfectly happy in not having penetrative sex. And by their own criteria, if they don't find it a problem, then really the therapist shouldn't treat it as a problem either. But in actual fact, they're all kind of horrified by this and think that these people are very aberrant. And I think it's kind of fascinating that still exists, that I think the gloss we get of a lot of pop kind of psychology stuff around sex therapy is very like, do what you want, do what you feel comfortable doing, and that rhetoric is still really there. But you break it down just a little bit, and like you say, you should be in a relationship, because none of this advice is aimed for single people. So sex, as you say, is absolutely an expectation of relationships, but it has to be penetrative sex in a heterosexual relationship as kind of the gold standard. And there's some great stuff by Jenny Kitzinger, probably about 20 years ago now, talking about how none of this advice makes sense in the context of lesbian sexual relationships. It just all completely falls apart. It only makes sense in a heterosexual paradigm.
You're likely familiar with Dan Savage. The sex columnist, I guess you would call him, although, of course, he does write on other stuff, but mostly about relationships and sex and sexuality. And, of course, his work isn't just centered around heterosexual relationships. He's gay and he writes a lot about, you know, queer sex, etc. But he coined this idea, good giving and game. Are you familiar with that concept?
I'm not, actually.
I mean, you could probably figure out what it means based on the words. But, you know, like, it's this idea that if you're in a relationship, that should be your approach to sex, that you should be sort of open-minded and willing to consider anything within reason because you want to please your partner and you want your partner to be happy, and that's sort of the deal and the contract that you enter into in intimate relationships. I wonder what you think about that idea.
I think it's, again, interesting the way it goes in cycles, and that I imagine, you know, that gets touted as quite progressive in some circles, I see, in the way that a lot of his advice does. But it echoes advice from decades, if not even centuries ago in sex therapy and sexology before that. And so you're having things like The Joy of Sex, the really famous Joy of Sex handbook from the 70s, very similar ideas. In fact, that's broken down. Food is a constant analogy with sex in a lot of pop sex therapy, and it is in the case of The Joy of Sex as well, where you have everything broken down into appetizers and entrees and main courses and what have you, and it's all quite nauseating if you actually read through it. But one of the things he says very early on is this kind of comparison of, well, even if you had a partner who really, really liked Chinese food and you didn't, you would eat it sometimes with them to make them happy. So this is exactly the same. Mm. And I think that it is really scary that all those notions that we have outside of regular everyday sexual relationships of consent, of, you know, positive affirmation and enjoyment of sexuality are supposed to go out the window in a long-term heterosexual relationship, and that there's huge pressure, as you say, to keep up a particular kind of sex. I think there's probably more pressure on agreeing to certain sex acts than others, for example, than, you know, there absolutely should be. That why is that consent irrelevant once you're in a long-term relationship? And I think it speaks volumes that we need this entire industry to kind of cajole women into having forms of sex that they often don't want to have.
Yeah. And why is that a bad analogy? You know, what's the difference between between eating Chinese food and sex?
Well, I guess forcing yourself to eat Chinese food you don't love is not the same as being coerced into sex that can end up being rape. And I suppose it's very similar to, in some ways, and I wrote about this in the book, the kind of continuation of, as Kathleen Barry talked about, prostitution sex in kind of bleeding into everyday life. And having done some studies recently about men's reviews of women in brothel prostitution, for example, it was really interesting the way that that gets represented as just like regular work. But then if you take consent away from that, it's rape. And I think it's the same kind of thing, that trying to run all these other analogies about sex in relationships is that you don't acknowledge if it goes wrong and there's coercion, or if this is someone agreeing to sex that they don't want, then, you know, you are looking at coercive sex, you are looking at abuse, and that has really traumatic consequences for the people involved, that maybe eating something you don't like doesn't.
Mm-hmm. And along those lines, you know, you, in your work around sex advice and sex therapy, you do use that feminist analysis of prostitution as a framework. I wonder if you can explain that a little more. You know, what's the connection between prostitution and the treatment of heterosexual relationships in sex advice, sex help books, or self-help books, and, you know, therapy?
I think the most obvious one, and the one that was kind of horrifying to me and meant that I was motivated a bit to look into this initially, was the way in which porn stars and women in prostitution were being held up as the kind of ultimate sex experts, because the more sex you have, the better you must be at it and the more you must know about it. And there was no kind of contextualizing, well, that is, you know, at its kind of most positive level, you could even say faking sexual enjoyment for a camera, as, you know, Ira Levy talks about in Female Chauvinist Pigs, that you have this sense of that sexual enjoyment then becomes actually just performing for someone else's enjoyment, and that gets conflated. So that was probably one of the most obvious ways in which this kind of notion of commodified sex in its most basic form was then being touted as the model for all women to mimic in their everyday heterosexual relationships. So there was kind of that side of it. But then there was the kind of more radical feminist analysis that has existed again for decades, sort of looking at, you know, that maybe the defining element of prostitution isn't just the economic exchange, which is often what is seen as separating it out from other forms of sexual interaction, but that it is the sexual inequality between men and women, and at its heart that one person's sexual desires determine everything that happens, and that there is one person in that interaction who is not getting their own interests or sexual desires or needs taken into consideration at all. They purely exist to meet the other person's perception of what they want. And that actually that model is really prevalent in sex therapy, particularly in self-help books for women. The self-help books for men are markedly different, which is also quite interesting.
Mm. You know, there's also this idea that I think is pretty common these days that is called maintenance sex. In your research, how common have you found this practice and this term to be, and what's your perspective on it?
It's interesting. I think in the literature I came across in doing that kind of research, in the academic side of things, unwanted sex is probably the more common usage that started bleeding into then these less harmful sounding terms like maintenance sex, you know, that there is this idea of just doing it anyway, even when you really don't want to, but it keeps kind of, you know, the relationship going, or it keeps everyone happy. And you know, in fact, we saw that with the post that went viral about one of the mummy bloggers talking about that, you know, just kind of getting it over and done with, because then that makes for an easier life. And I think sexologists have really struggled to categorize that. And they certainly wouldn't say it's a bad thing generally, and that they think that high levels of sexual interaction are really important. In fact, again, I was sort of shocked to read how many of them were sort of counselling women who were saying they were still having sex with their husbands, even though they had three or four small children. They were still having sex with their husbands 3 to 4 times a week, but he wasn't happy with that amount. So could something be done to help the woman have more sex? And they wouldn't say, hey, you know what, actually there's nothing wrong with you. And that sounds like actually quite a lot of sexual activity in a house, you know, where there's a hell of a lot else going on. So definitely there's the constant kind of, you know, treatment of women as aberrant regardless of, but there is no benchmark. The benchmark is his sexual desires, I guess. So the maintenance sex fits quite well into that, right? That it's not about what women want and whether or not they want any physical enjoyment or connection out of that sexual activity. This is about kind of maintaining heterosexuality at all costs, and the ultimate kind of benchmark of good heterosexuality is meeting male sexual desires. So I think maintenance sex is a really harmful concept, that this is, you know, absolutely normalizing the idea that women shouldn't be connected or entitled to enjoy or want the sex that they actually participate in. And I think, again, we saw the kind of pointy end of that in the sexological literature, that after Viagra came out, which again seems so normal now, I think, you know, when I talk to my undergraduate students, they actually can't imagine a time before Viagra, when men sometimes had to just put up with not getting erections, for example. They can't imagine a world where that's normal. But after Viagra came out and seemingly kind of solved erectile dysfunction, according to a lot of people in the sexology and sex therapy industries, then there was this huge shift in attention to, like, okay, well, how do we get women to now deal with the fact that there are a hell of a lot more erections going around, often in relationships with older women, for example, who hadn't had penetrative sex for a long time. And one of the things that they sort of started to develop was this idea of receptivity. And actually that women maybe in their idea didn't go around with just active sexual desire, wanting sex, that they had to be kind of awakened by men's touch and then get interested in sex. So So they were encouraging women to just agree to sex first off and see how they felt about it. And maybe, you know, a few minutes in, then they might find that it wasn't so bad and they might end up enjoying it. And that was kind of their great idea for the leap forward of women's sexual therapy treatment, was going to be encouraging them to just give it a go for a while and see what happened. And again, it's kind of extraordinary that we're saying that this was the way forward, when in actual fact, it was sort of like the Sleeping Beauty model of women's sexuality that has existed for centuries, that women don't have any sexual desires of their own. They only exist in relation to men.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, speaking of Viagra, in recent years, there's been this real push to find a female Viagra, in quotations. And in order to justify this push to come up with something that will, you know, increase women's libidos, there's also been a lot of talk about sexual dysfunction in women. And, you know, the idea that if a woman doesn't desire sex, she's dysfunctional in some way, and that's a problem that can or should be treated. I wonder, have you studied that phenomenon at all?
Not directly, but kind of doing analyses of the literature that deals with sexual dysfunction. And, I mean, it's from someone outside the field studying it as a political scientist and sociologist. It's just astounding, some of the claims that get made. And you think one of the spikes after, as you say, the interest in Viagra and then the interest in trying to find a female Viagra, was this really widespread claim that came out of the Journal of the American Medical Association, you know, really highly regarded medical journal, claiming that most women were sexually dysfunctional. And it was, you know, obviously huge for marketers of all, you know, the rush to find some kind of pharmaceutical product for this was huge. But it was that no one ever questioned their assumptions, that they were going around saying most women were sexually dysfunctional. And what does dysfunctional mean if you're actually talking about a majority of women? And, you know, kind of it goes back to it again, you know, it's funny seeing how often these things reoccur. It made me think of the Height Report from the 80s, you know, finding that a majority of women say they almost never, rarely or never orgasm in penetrative sex with men. And that is still classified as a disorder, even though we know that actually represents a hell of a lot of women's experiences. And that is really unchanged. And I guess there's that, it's the bedrock of not wanting to question what we think sex is, which is kind of penetrative heterosexual sex that focuses on male pleasure, and then telling women they're dysfunctional for not liking that, rather than saying, actually, maybe this whole setup we've got isn't about women's pleasure, so it's not surprising that women aren't gagging to do it. Well, certainly not all women, anyway.
I wonder if you think there's anything to this idea of sexual empowerment. I mean, it's something that we hear about so much as far as, you know, third wave feminism goes and the sex positive movement that's really taken off in the past couple of decades. Is it possible, do you think, for women to be or to feel empowered through sex, or do you think that's kind of a bunk concept?
I suppose it's trying to separate out what sex is under patriarchy and what it might be. And I think just like adopting anything as is, you know, in terms of beauty practices or in terms of kind of other patriarchal standards of femininity, it is difficult to find them empowering under patriarchy or believe that at a rational and analytical level they can actually be empowering. That doesn't mean some women don't enjoy them, just as it does with all other things. But I think the difference with sexuality for me is that, you know, if you're looking at it at a global scale on an anthropological level, this really is seen as such a fundamental part of our lives as human beings. You know, it absolutely, sexuality doesn't have to, and we can see worldwide, doesn't necessarily take the form that we believe the gold standard of sex is in terms of heterosexual penetrative sex like it is in much of the West. But I wouldn't want to throw sexuality out, you know, kind of baby with the bathwater scenario. There have been some great feminist activists that have. Women Against Sex in the 1970s was a really good example of that. talking about maybe women should just withdraw from sex and sexuality altogether. But, you know, I suppose for me, I've got to keep some level of optimism about what we might be able to achieve under different circumstances. And I often go back to Andrew Dworkin on that, thinking about, you know, that there's some kind of underground resistance in women thinking that there might be a humane sensuality that we can achieve outside of what the patriarchal structures of sexuality are come the revolution, that that could in fact be a strong source of power and enjoyment for women.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I was younger and, you know, before I sort of became more radical in my feminism, I think I did really think that sex was really central to our existence and to our lives. And, you know, ironically, when I did think that, I wasn't having orgasms yet, so.
Very.
But, you know, today I'm in my late 30s and my perspective is more that sex is overemphasized. And so I have definitely, you know, during my 30s, I'd say, started to push back against the narrative that sex is what makes a relationship good and that we're obligated to have sex with our partners. But I've also noticed that this makes people perceive me as a kind of prude. So I've noticed it's because people call me a prude. I've picked up on that. It isn't, you know, it's not just men that are pushing that narrative, you know, like I can't really even think of a man that I know in my personal life who's used that word to describe me, but it's women often, you know, like I have more than one female friend who's accused me of prudery. And I wonder why you think women do this to one another. You know, why do women accuse one another of being prudes or of being bad partners for challenging our cultural expectations of sex or our understanding of sexual relationships with men?
I mean, I suppose there's the, you know, the old concept of horizontal violence that, you know, women or any oppressed group will often keep other members of that group in line more overtly than a more powerful group. And I do think that sexuality is still kind of one of the big battle zones for patriarchal norms, I suppose. And with so many others, I think it's hard to justify with biology. And I guess that is so interwoven with our understanding of sexuality in terms of dominant discourses in the West that people get very threatened when you talk about it as being culturally constructed or, like you said, overemphasized. And indeed, I heard Gail Dines once talk at a conference saying exactly as you've just said, that the older she gets, the more she thinks we just have a culture obsessed with this for no good reason. Mm-hmm. And that it is kind of like, she said, it's like teenage boys are kind of running the culture. Mm-hmm. So it is really threatening on some level, I think, when you stop doing that, in the same way that, again, you know, you might say women who stop shaving their underarm hair sometimes get, you know, looks and stares and comments from other women, because there is something kind of threatening about saying, actually, you can step outside these norms. And I think it's easier to believe it's not possible or it's biologically determined. And when you see women making those other decisions, even if you don't blame women who don't follow that path, but if you can see it can be done, then that can be quite threatening to the conceptions you've been carrying around. And, I mean, certainly that's what, you know, lesbian feminists have been arguing for decades, that just the idea of lesbian feminism is so threatening to the whole system that they're often not taken seriously or it's not seen as a central idea, that you could, in fact, overthrow heterosexuality by women's just simple withdrawing of energy from it at a very basic level.
Mm-hmm. And how do you respond to those kinds of accusations? I don't know if you've been called a prude or, you know, been accused of being sex negative. Oh, yes. Or something like that. Yeah.
Very. I once made badges that said prude because I thought it was just easier to get it over and done with. People might know as soon as they meet me then not to ask the wrong questions. I had prude on one side and frigid on the other.
Perfect. And so how do you respond to those kinds of accusations?
I suppose I've come to more laugh at it or embrace it like that. I don't think that's necessarily a politically useful way of going about it, but personally very useful, that you can just kind of say, well, what of it? Yeah, all right, you think I'm a prude. I don't really care. And I suppose, yeah, that's on a day-to-day level, that's quite useful in that I really did get to the point that I don't care anymore. But I suppose the anti-sex thing irritates me for the same reason I'm sure it irritates so many feminists. When you are trying to reclaim this as something that could potentially be something positive in our lives, or that women should be entitled to want and desire and access sexual pleasure in ways that they find fulfilling, and that we've kind of lost that as even an option because you're being presented with, you know, either do it the way that the dominant construction has been presented to you through popular culture, or withdraw from it altogether. And I think that's what people say when you even just threaten the edges of the dominant construction of heterosexuality, you're a prude. There is kind of no restructuring it, remaking it. Not that I have some great hope for that, but in terms of our personal lives, maybe just trying to buy out of it a bit while still being heterosexual, for example, in my case, that even that is seen as prudish. Anything that isn't full-on wholesale agreement with the dominant construction of heterosexuality is seen as anti-sex. And again, I think it suggests how fundamental the dominant construction of heterosexuality is to patriarchy, that people think even just fraying that at the edges might bring the whole system down. So we desperately have to stop or shun people from talking about the fact that this might not be the way it has to be.
Mm-hmm. And finally, what do you wish would change? You know, what do you think a feminist approach to relationships or sex therapy would look like, for example? What could change in terms of sex advice and relationship advice to center women and empower women in an actually feminist way?
I think that is such a tough question, really, and I have changed my opinion back and forth over the years as to whether or not a feminist sex therapy is truly possible. I know some great women who have tried, but obviously the system of sex therapy is so founded on really harmful concepts to women that I think it is difficult to imagine how you could still work within that framework in a positive way. But then at the same time, I do feel like there's a lot of women who do go to sex therapists, and the more feminists you can get in there who don't say things like, absolutely, you have to be okay with your partner watching violent pornography. You know, I think the more women who can find therapists who say, actually, you're allowed to say no to that, and that's perfectly fine, that as an interim measure, that that's really important, that women can go for help and be reassured. And I guess my ultimate aim was that women should be allowed to say no. I guess that was years ago that was what I kept thinking, that the support for women, what needed to underlie it all, was that it was okay to say no to all of these things, including just sex altogether, you know, any kind of sex interaction that you might want to have another person. It was okay to not be involved in that and to say no to it. And I still think that's really true, and that's fundamental. You know, and we can't ignore the context, I guess, in which we exist, that there is such widespread sexual harassment and sexual violence against women that it's kind of extraordinary that you would ever seek heterosexual relationships under those conditions at all. You know, you're kind of, and sex therapy generally, you know, as a discipline, ignores that context altogether. It doesn't understand the constant threat of sexual violence that women live in. It doesn't understand the unequal relations between men and women. But it was actually my thesis supervisor who I remember challenging me on that and said, you know, but that's all good for the moment, that you just want no as your absolute baseline, and that all women need to eventually be in positions one day where they can say no to anything they don't want to do. But that's not a great utopian vision. And, you know, that for her was then where lesbian feminism came in, and thinking about, well, you know, what kind of power could women have if they developed those sexual bonds together, or that there was more room for women to develop those bonds together, and what sexual enjoyment might look like under those kind of conditions instead, and that maybe we do need a utopia where we can imagine it being outside of this system, as well as the interim tools to kind of deal with the oppression as it's experienced now.
Thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You just heard an interview with Megan Tyler, a senior lecturer at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia, and the author of Selling Sex Short, The Sexological and Pornographic Construction of Women's Sexuality in the West. That's all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at feministcurrent, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen: iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Show the world radical feminism is worth listening to. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced and edited by myself, Megan Murphy, out of Vancouver, BC. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org. And finally, if you enjoyed this podcast, consider making a donation to support our work. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button.